But ultimately, the aim was not to breed hundreds of thousands of female partisans. The proportion of young men in these sports facilities had to be raised markedly. Such were my musings when two men blocked my path.
"Oi, you Jewish bastard," one said. "Do you think we're just going to sit back and watch you insult Germany?"
the second said. Slowly, I removed my hat and showed my face in the light of a street lamp. "Step back into the ranks, you vermin," I said, unruffled, "or you'll end up like Röhm." For a while, neither of them said another word. Then the second man hissed,
"What sort of a sick bastard are you?
First you get that face operated on, then you use it to stab Germany in the back."
"A sick, vile bastard,"
the first one said. Something glinted in his hand. With incredible speed, his fist hurtled towards my face. Attempting to maintain my poise and my pride, I did not evade the blow. It was like being hit by a bullet. There was no pain, only speed, only a powerful impact. Then the wall of the building rushed silently towards me. I tried to keep my footing, but something hit the back of my head hard. The building shot past above me. My hand felt in my coat pocket. I grabbed the opera tickets and took them out, while the blows around me increased. The English must have new artillery, a murderous barrage. It became so dark. How could they aim with such accuracy? Our graves, like the end of the world. I didn't even know where my helmet was, or my faithful dog. My foxhole. My foxhole. My foxhole. Chapter 34. The first thing I saw was a glaring neon light. "I hope somebody's been looking after Wenck's army," I thought. Then I looked around the room, and when I caught sight of the apparatus, it soon became clear that there was no pressing need for Wenck's army just for now. Beside me was a type of coat stand, to which several plastic sacks had been attached. The contents of these dripped slowly into my right arm. The left was in a rigid plaster mould. This was not so simple to observe, for I was unable to open the eye on the non-plaster side. I was baffled. It all looked mightily painful, and yet I could feel no pain, save for a permanent thudding in my head. I turned my head to afford a better reconnaissance of my situation, then raised it carefully, triggering a sudden and sharp pain in my chest. I could hear a door open on the other side of the room, but decided not to look over. The face of a nurse appeared cautiously above the bridge of my nose. "Are you awake?"
"Ugh,"
I said. This was intended to be a question about the date, but my mouth issued no more than a sound somewhere between a grunt and a rasp.
"Good," she said. "Now, don't go back to sleep, will you? I'm going to fetch the doctor."
I wheezed in reply. I could already tell that in all likelihood I had suffered no permanent damage, just a slight rusting of the vocal cords as a result of their not having been used for some time. I rotated my functioning eye. In my field of vision was a small table on which sat a telephone and a bouquet of flowers. I saw a device which must be monitoring my pulse. I tried to move my legs, but soon abandoned the attempt, as it was probable that this would incur further pain. Instead, I essayed some short speaking exercises. I presumed, after all, that I would have a question or two to put to the doctor. In fact, nothing happened for a considerable length of time. I had forgotten how things tended to be in hospital if one is not Führer and Reich Chancellor. The patient is supposed to recover, but in fact all he does is wait. He waits for nurses, treatment, doctors. Ostensibly, everything is going to happen soon or
straight away. Whereas straight away means in half an hour to 45 minutes, and soon means in an hour or more. I was overcome by an acute urge, and I sensed at once that a certain provision had been made for this too. I would have liked to have taken a look at the television for a while, only the operating of this machine was as perplexing to me as it was physically impossible. So I stared motionlessly at the wall opposite and tried to reconstruct recent events. I recalled a moment in a patient transport vehicle and Fräulein Krohmeier's screams. Confusingly, my mind played that short sequence over and again in which I greeted Francis' surrender with a spontaneous leap or dance for joy. And yet I wasn't wearing a uniform, but a turquoise tutu. Then Göring came up to me, leading two saddled reindeer, and said, "Mein Führer, when you're in Poland, please get me some curd cheese. I'll cook us something fabulous this evening." I looked at him incredulously and said, "Göring, you fool! Can't you see I don't have any pockets?" At this, Göring burst into tears, and someone was shaking my shoulder. "Herr Hitler? Herr Hitler?" I woke with a start, jerking up as far as my body would allow. "The war doctor's here." A young man in a white coat offered me his hand, which I was barely able to shake. "Here we are," he said. "I'm Dr. Radulescu."
"Considering your name, you speak remarkably fluent German," I croaked. "No trace of an accent."
"Considering the state you're in, you're remarkably talkative," the imported doctor said. "Do you know how I perfected my German accent?" I shook my head wearily. 13 years of school, 9 semesters studying medicine, 2 years working abroad, then I married my wife and took her name." I nodded and coughed. Assaulted by pain, I tried to avoid coughing again, at the same time attempting to exude an element of strength and Führer-like leadership qualities. The outcome of not coughing, however, was that a number of small and unlovely bits and pieces shot out of my nose. All in all, I felt miserable. "Let's get one thing out of the way first. You're in better physical shape than you look. There's nothing that won't heal or get working again properly in time."
"My voice,"
I moaned.
"I'm an orator."
"There's nothing wrong with your voice. It's just out of practice, hence the dry throat. What you must do is keep drinking, all the time. If I'm not mistaken," he said, glancing down beside my bed, "you don't even have to worry about waste disposal for the time being. Let's see, what else have we got? A nasty fracture of the cheekbone, severe concussion, several ugly bruises on the jaw. But the most puzzling thing is that it's not broken. The guys in casualty immediately put money on a knuckle duster. If they're right, you can thank your lucky stars 10 times over. Your swollen eye might not be pretty, but it'll work again. And then we've got a broken collarbone, broken arm, a clean break, which is perfect, 5 broken ribs, and we had to open you up to put that rupture of your liver right again. While we're on the subject, might I say that you've got one of the finest livers we've ever seen. Am I right in thinking you don't drink?" I nodded weakly.
"Vegetarian, too."
"Your results really are excellent. You might make it to 120.
"Won't be enough,"
I said dreamily. "Now, now," he laughed. "You got plenty of time ahead of you. I can't see any problems. You're just going to have to be patient."
"You really ought to report this to the police," the nurse said.
"That would suit those villains down to the ground. What would Röhm have given to have been reported to the police?"
"I'm not your lawyer," said the doctor with the Romanian name, "but with injuries like this..."
"I shall strike back in my own way," I coughed,
and it occurred to me that Rarely in my life had I uttered such an empty threat.
I'd rather you tell me how much longer you intend to keep me here.
A week or two, if there are no complications, maybe a little longer. Then you can recuperate properly at home and let everything fuse together again. Right now, you should get some more sleep. And do think about telling the police. The nurse is absolutely right. I know you should turn the other cheek, but that doesn't give people the right to administer beatings like that.
And have a think about your menu. This was the nurse showing me a list of meals. We need to know what you'd like to eat during your stay with us.
I pushed the list away.
No special treatment. Simple soldiers' rations. Vegetarian, like the ancient Greeks.
She looked at me, sighed, ticked a dozen or so boxes, and gave me back the list. You'll have to sign it. Feebly, I signed with the hand I could move. Then I passed out again. I was standing at a bus stop in the Ukraine, holding a huge bowl of curd cheese. Göring wasn't there, and I remember just how much that irritated me.
Chapter 35.
I did, in fact, briefly consider reporting the matter to the police, but then dismissed the idea. It contradicted all my principles. The Führer cannot assume the role of victim. It is not right. He is not dependent on the intercession or assistance of such wretched characters as state prosecutors or police officials. He does not hide behind them. He grabs the law with his own fist. Or rather, he offers it to the burning hands of the SS, and then they grab it with their many fists. If I'd had an SS at my disposal, this obscure party headquarters would have gone up in flames the very next evening, and within a week, each one of its cowardly members would have had the opportunity to ponder the true principles of the racial idea while bathed in a pool of their own blood. But from whom could I demand such brutality in these peaceable times, in which people had been weaned off violence? Savatsky was a man for deft punchlines rather than punches. He worked with his brain, not his brawn. All I could do at this juncture was to defer the matter to an unspecified time in the future and take great care that no press photographer would have the opportunity to take some unfavourable pictures of me when I availed myself of the sanitary facilities of the hospital. The incident itself could not be kept secret, however, and only a few days later it was reported in the newspaper that I had been the victim of far-right violence. It was, of course, the usual journalistic incompetence to exalt these feeble-minded stooges as far-right, a label they did not merit. But every cloud has its silver lining, and within a few days, even hours, I had quite a number of extraordinary telephone exchanges with people to whom Fräulein Kurmeier, at the suggestion of Herr Savatsky and with his blessing, had given the number of my mobile telephone. The first conversation, other than those with flashlight colleagues wishing me a speedy recovery, was conducted with Frau Kunast, who inquired about my well-being and wanted to know if I did actually belong to any party. "Of course," I said. "My own." Kunast laughed and said that the NSDAP was, for the time being at least, dozing or in hibernation. Until it awoke, she continued, I ought to consider whether the Green Party couldn't offer a home to me. The man who had risked life and limb in opposition to right-wing violence. At least for a while, she said, repeating her invitation with a laugh. I digested the telephone call with a shake of my head, and would most likely have dismissed it as another curious figment of the democratic parliamentary imagination, had not another call come the following day along surprisingly similar lines. I had a gentleman on the telephone who, as I dimly recollect, was either just completing an apprenticeship as Minister of Health or had already done so. Even after much thought, I no longer recall his name. In any case, I gave up trying to keep a track of this party long ago. After all, rumours are frequently aired on the relevant broadcasting slots that the only remaining elderly gentleman of the Alliance is an out-and-out dipsomaniac. In my opinion, this is unfair on the man. I rather take the view that it must be utterly impossible to last for even an hour in this bizarre game of political ring-a-ring-a-roses without appearing inebriated. The apprentice health minister told me how sorry he was about the assault, especially on someone like myself, who, as he put it, was a standard-bearer for the broadest freedoms of opinion and speech and needed all the support he could get at this difficult time. I scarcely had the opportunity to emphasize that the strong man is mightiest alone, for the apprentice was already insisting that he would do his utmost to ensure I was back on the television screen as soon as possible. For a moment, I was terrified that he would take my treatment in his own notoriously soft-fingered and incompetent hands. Instead, he asked me with feigned casualness about my party affiliation, and I answered him truthfully. The apprentice roared with boyish laughter. Then he said I was hilarious and suggested that, as the NSDAP was currently at rest in the graveyard of history, maybe the FDP could become my new political home. I told him that he and his colleagues should finally stop insulting my party and that I had no interest of any sort in his crowd of liberal maggots. The apprentice laughed once more and said he loved it when I was like this. He could tell I would soon be my old self again. Before he hung up, he promised to have an application for membership sent to me, unsolicited. The telephone, it struck me at that moment, is the wrong means of communication for people without ears. And barely had I put the darn thing down than it rang again. It turned out that the apprentice health minister and Kunast the Green were by no means the only ones who had decided to put their own individual interpretations on my unflinching blood sacrifice. A number of callers from different parties congratulated me on my unequivocal championing of non-violence, which in their view was manifested by my demonstrative refusal to resort to self-defense. These callers included a man from the only grouping whose name aroused any sympathy in me, the Animal Protection Party. I had a very pleasant conversation with this fellow, during the course of which he generously brought my attention to some atrocities perpetrated against Romanian street dogs, which were beyond belief. I resolved in the near future to devote particular attention to the outrageous goings-on in that country. Recent events were also interpreted quite differently in the eyes of those professional politicians. The Solidarity Civil Rights Movement declared me to be a fellow sufferer of their party founder, Larouche, who had been persecuted somehow or other. Meanwhile, a strange foreigners' party by the name of BIG assured me that in a country where the beating up of foreigners was outlawed, the beating up of Germans was, of course, outlawed too. To which I gave the emphatic response that I should not wish to live in a country where the beating up of foreigners was outlawed. This produced another outburst of raucous laughter at the other end of the line. For others, I was not a symbol for freedom of opinion, but against it, at least against the wrong opinions. I was not only regarded as a champion against violence, but by several parties as a champion for it. CSU, two gun clubs, and a manufacturer of firearms. And once as a victim of violence against the elderly, the Family Party. I was particularly struck by the dilettantism of an appeal by the Pirate Party, which thought it had identified in my refusal to press charges a protest against the surveillance state. It saw me as an advocate of extreme independence from the state and what they termed total pirate thinking. those that came closest to the truth were a grouping called the Violets, who saw in my case evidence of a world beyond the purely materialistic, and in me a man who, under the banner of total peaceableness, had subjected his return to the harshest tests with the greatest possible forbearance. I laughed for so long that I had to ask for extra painkillers for my ribs. Fräulein Krömeyer brought me more post from the office. She, too, had been called on the telephone several times, mostly by individuals from the same parties or groupings, but new were the communications from diverse communist organizations. It has now slipped my mind why they got in touch, but I do not suppose the reason was much different from Stalin's in 1939, when he concluded our non-aggression pact. What united these callers and scribes was that they were all soliciting my membership of their respective associations. Only two parties, in fact, failed to contact me. Simpletons would probably put this down to indifference, but I knew better. Which is why, when an unknown Berlin number flashed on my telephone the following day, I hollered speculatively, "Hello? Is that the SPD?" Yes. Am I speaking to Herr Hitler?" a voice at the other end of the line said. "Indeed you are," I said. "I've been waiting for you to call." "For me?" "Not specifically, but for someone from the SPD. Who's speaking, please?" "Gabriel. Sigmar Gabriel. It's fantastic that you can speak on the phone again. I heard and read the most awful things. You sound back on form. That's purely on account of your telephone call." "Really? Are you that pleased I phoned?" "No, not as such. I'm pleased because it took you so long. In the time it takes for German social democracy to conceive of an idea, one could cure two severe cases of tuberculosis." Gabrielle snickered, and it sounded exceedingly natural. "You're right, sometimes that's certainly the case. Look, this is exactly why I'm calling." "I know, because my own party is in hibernation at present."
"What party?"
"You disappoint me, Gabriel. What is the name of my party?"
"Go on."
"Excuse me, I'm not exactly sure what your..."
"NSDA."
"P?"
"Precisely, P. It's having a rest at the moment, and you would like to know whether I might just be looking for a new home in your party."
"Well, I was actually..."
"By all means, send your forms to my office," I said chattily.
"Listen, have you just taken some painkillers or a few too many sleeping tablets?"
"No," I said, and was about to add that I wouldn't need any after this conversation. Then it occurred to me that Gabriel might be right. One never really knows what on earth doctors and nurses administer via those bags with tubes. And it also struck me that, in its present form, this SPD was no longer a party to be rounded up and incarcerated in a concentration camp. Its sluggishness might even render it useful in some matters. I therefore made immediate reference to some of the medicines I was taking and took my leave very cordially. I leaned back on my pillow, wondering who might be the next person to call. In fact, all that I was missing was a telephone conversation with someone from the Chancellor's Electoral Union. Who might that be? The lumpy matron herself was out of the question, of course. But I wouldn't have minded speaking to the Employment Minister. I was dying to know why she had stopped procreating only one child away from receiving the Gold Mother's Cross. That Gutenberg would have been interesting, too, even though he had emerged from a centuries-deep swamp of aristocratic incest. Here was a man who had the capacity to think in a wider context, without allowing professorial objections endlessly to get in the way. But his political heyday seemed now to be past. Who else? The ecological fellow with the spectacles? The drip of a whip
The wheelchair-bound aspiring conservative Swabian in charge of finances.
And there were the Valkyries, scouring the battlefields for fallen heroes once more. The number was unfamiliar to me, but the area code was Berlin. I concluded it must be the windbag. "Good day, Herr Pofalla," I said.
"I'm sorry?"
This was indisputably the voice of a woman. I put her as a bit older, maybe mid-50s. "I do beg your pardon. Who is speaking?"
"My name is Goltz, Beate Goltz."
And she uttered the name of a well-known German-sounding publishing house.
"And to whom am I speaking?"
"Hitler,"
I said, clearing my throat. "I'm terribly sorry, I was expecting somebody else."
"Is this a bad time? Your office said it would be fine for me to phone in the..."
"No, no," I said. "It's perfectly all right, but kindly put no more questions about how I'm feeling."
"Is it that bad?"
"No, but I'm beginning to sound like an old gramophone record."
"Herr Hitler, I'm calling to ask whether you'd like to write a book."
"I already have," I said. "Two, in fact."
"I know, more than 10 million copies. We're very impressed. But someone with your potential ought not to leave a gap of 80 years.
"Well, look, that gap was not entirely within my control."
"You're absolutely right. I can well understand that writing doesn't come so easily when the Russians are rolling over your bunker."
"Indeed," I said.
I could barely have put it better myself.
I was pleasantly surprised by Frau Goltz's ability to empathize. "But now the Russians are no longer here, and however much we enjoy your weekly roundup on the telly, I think it's time the Führer produced another report on his view of the world. Or, before I make a total fool of myself here, do you already have other contractual commitments?"
"No, I'm usually published by Franz Eher," I said, but then realized that by now he must be in retirement too.
"I'm assuming you haven't heard from your publisher in a while."
"In point of fact, you're right," I mused. "I wonder who's cashing in my royalties at this moment."
"The state of Bavaria, if I'm rightly informed," Frau Goltz said.
"What impertinence!"
"You could sue, of course, but you know what the courts are like."
"You're telling me."
"I'd be delighted, however, if you took the somewhat simpler route instead."
"Which would be?"
"You write a new book, in a new world. We'd be happy to publish it, and as we're all professionals here, I can offer you the following."
Then she set forth a schedule of major marketing strategies and mentioned a sum as an advance payment, which, even in this suspect euro money, elicited my approval, though, of course, I kept this to myself for the time being.
I would also be allowed to choose my own colleagues, whose remuneration would likewise be covered by the publishing house.
"Our one condition, it must be the truth." I rolled my eyes.
"I suppose you'll be wanting to know what my real name is."
"No, no, no. Your name is Adolf Hitler, of course. What other name would we put on the book? Moses Halbgewachs?" I laughed.
"Oh, Schmuel Rosenzweig, I like you."
"What I'm trying to say is that we're not after a humorous book. I assume you'd be thinking along the same lines. The Führer doesn't make jokes." It was astonishing how simple everything was with this woman. She knew exactly what she was talking about, and with whom.
"Will you have a think about it?"
"Give me a little time," I said. "I will be in touch." I waited for 5 minutes precisely. Then I called her back. I demanded a substantially higher sum. In retrospect, I have to presume that she was expecting this.
"Okay, then. Sieg Heil," she said.
"May I take that as a deal?" I asked.
"You may," she laughed.
Then a deal it is.
Chapter 36. It is quite extraordinary. For the first time in ages, I am not bothered by the snow, even though it has come so early this year. Large flakes are falling outside the window. In 1943, this would have driven me mad. Now I know that everything has a deeper significance, that destiny does not expect me to win a world war at the first or second attempt, that she is giving me time and has trust in me. Now I can properly enjoy this mellow pre-Christmas tranquillity once more, after some arduous years. And I am enjoying them almost as much as I did when I was a child, huddled up in a cozy corner of the parlour with Homer's account of the Trojan War. There is still pain in my ribcage, but it is heartening to feel that it is abating. The publishing house has supplied me with a dictation machine. Savatsky wanted me to use my mobile telephone, but in the end I've found the dictation machine easier to operate. Press a button, it records. Press a button, it stops. In general, I'm very much against this multiplication of tasks. The wireless has to play these silver discs, too. The razor machine has to work for both wet and dry shaving. The petrol pump attendant doubles up as a grocer, while the telephone has to be a telephone, a calendar, a camera, and everything else besides. This is dangerous nonsense, the only possible consequence of which is that thousands of our young people will be mown down on the roads because they cannot stop staring into their screens. One of my first undertakings will be to outlaw such telephone devices, or allow them only for those inferior racial elements remaining in our society. For the latter, I may even make them compulsory. Then they will litter the main thoroughfares of Berlin like squashed hedgehogs. So they do have their practical uses, but otherwise utter nonsense. Certainly it would be far more advantageous for the state finances if the Luftwaffe could also assume the task of refuse collection. But what sort of a Luftwaffe would we have then? A good idea. I will dictate it immediately into the device. In the corridor outside, they have stuck up voluminous quantities of Christmas decorations, stars, fir branches, and much more. On Sundays in Advent, there is Glühwein, of which they have now developed a most pleasant non-alcoholic variety, although I have my doubts that it will ever find acceptance amongst the troops. Ah, well, a private will always be a private. On reflection, I cannot say that Christmas decorations have become more tasteful with the passing of the years. A most disagreeable industrialization has taken hold. I'm not concerned about whether something is kitsch or not, for every example of kitsch harbors a residue of the feelings of the simple man, and since that is the case, there will always be the possibility of a development towards real art. No. What really bothers me is that the importance of Father Christmas has grown disproportionately, doubtlessly as a result of Anglo-American cultural infiltration. The candle, meanwhile, has fallen in significance. Perhaps it only seems like this because candles are not permitted here in the hospital for fire safety reasons. And, much as I appreciate the careful handling of Volk property, I cannot recall large numbers of buildings having been damaged during my time in government, despite the generous use of candles. But I do concede that from 1943 onwards, the statistics become rather less meaningful, given the increasing absence of buildings. Nonetheless, a Christmas like this has its own charm. Free from the burden of governmental responsibility, which in the longer term will be inevitable, I ought to enjoy it while it lasts. I can say that the personnel are making great efforts to take care of me. I talk to them a lot about their working conditions, about the social services, which, as I am learning more and more, are in such a wretched state that it is well nigh a miracle anybody can be cured at all. I get many visits from doctors, coming to me off duty,
They sit down and tell me about the latest example of effrontery from the current blunderer masquerading as the health minister. There are just as many incidences of absurd behaviour involving his predecessor, they say, and no doubt the same will be true of his successor. I must address the matter in my programme, they urge me, and announce in no uncertain terms that change is urgently required. I promise that soon I will tackle this with all my energies. Occasionally, I comment that it would help if fewer foreigners were treated here on the ward. They laugh, say, "Well, of course you could see it that way," followed immediately by a "but joking aside," after which comes a tale of the next outrage, of which there seems to be no shortage. There is also a strikingly charming nurse, a fiery character, bright and cheerful. Her name is Irmgard, in fact, but I definitely need to pace myself. Were I 20 years younger, maybe. Herr Savatsky has just been to visit with Fräulein Kurmeier, or should I say, the former Fräulein Kurmeier. I still find it hard to get used to saying Frau Savatsky. The two of them have a happy event looming, and she's already as round as a ball. She insists she can still manage, but it cannot be very long before her belly starts to become a real burden. She has taken on a little colour, or maybe taken off a little white. I still find all that difficult to understand. But I have to say that they make a marvellous couple, and when they look at each other, I know that in 19 or 20 years a strapping grenadier will be at their side, impeccable genetic material for the Waffen-SS, and later for the party. They asked me where I was spending Christmas, and then invited me over, which delighted me. But I don't think I shall bother them. Christmas is a family celebration. "But you're practically part of the family?" Frau Savatsky said. "Just at the moment," I said, for Schwester Irmgard was coming through the door. "Just at the moment, Schwester Irmgard is my family." Schwester Irmgard laughed and said, "Over my dead body. I'm just popping in to check he's all right." "He is fine," I grinned, and she let out such a hearty laugh that I almost considered putting off the next stage in my political career for a year or two. "Frau Bellini and Herr Sensenbrink send their best wishes," Savatsky said. "Frau Bellini's going to come tomorrow or the day after with the outcome of the meeting about the new slot, the new studio." "You must have seen it," I said. "What is your impression?" "You won't be disappointed, I can tell you. There's a pile of money behind it. You've not heard this from me, but there's still plenty left in the budget. Plenty." "That's enough," Frau Savatsky said, cutting him off. "We've got to go and buy a pram before I can't move any more." "Okay, okay," Savatsky replied. "But do think about my suggestion." I could have sworn that as the two of them left, he said something like, "Have you told him what the baby's going to be called?" But I may have been mistaken. Yes, his suggestion. He is absolutely right. It is a perfectly logical step. If a handful of parties are inviting one to become a member, one would be well advised not to give one's valuable self to causes other than one's own. In 1919, I would have foundered in another party. Instead, I took over a tiny, insignificant party and shaped it according to my wishes, which was far more effective. In this case, with the impetus of a book publication and a new program scheduled, I could launch a propaganda offensive and then start a movement. He has already sent to my mobile telephone some designs for placards. I like them. I really like them. They are of me, and they're modelled closely on the old ones. They're more striking with the old typeface, Savatsky says, and he's right. I should listen to him. He has a knack for this. He has also devised a new electoral slogan. It will be plastered at the bottom of all the placards, giving them a common thread. The slogan addresses old virtues, old doubts, and for good measure, has a humorous, conciliatory element to win over those pirate voters and other young people. The slogan reads, "It wasn't all bad." I think we can work with that. Translator's note. Timur Vermish's cutting satire offers a unique perspective on our modern, media-bloated world, in which celebrity is worshipped above all else. The rapid progress of globalization over the past two decades means that most of the material in the novel will resonate with audiences in all Western societies, rather than just in Germany. But for those readers who feel they may have missed some or many of the cultural and historical references, what follows is a brief resume. Adolf Hitler, 1889 to 1945, we dare assume, is sufficiently well known for no introduction to be necessary. A few biographical notes up to his takeover of power in 1933, however, may serve to clarify some of the observations made in the book. Having left school at 16, Hitler moved to Vienna, where he supported himself by working as a casual labourer and selling his watercolours. Twice rejected by the Academy of Fine Arts, Hitler fell into poverty, living in a shelter for the homeless, then a men's workhouse. He volunteered immediately to fight in 1914 and was awarded the Iron Cross for bravery. After the end of World War I, Hitler moved to Munich, where he joined the embryonic National Socialist Party and soon gained a reputation as an orator. After the failed Beer Hall Putsch of 1923, Hitler was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment, but served only one, during which time he wrote Mein Kampf. Following his early release, he rebuilt the party, became its undisputed leader, and the meteoric rise of the Nazis began. Eva Braun, 1912-45, was his long-term partner who only became the Führer's wife for the last couple of days of their life. Having already undertaken a couple of unsuccessful suicide attempts in the 1930s, she finally managed it together with Adolf in the bunker. One of the great ironies of the Third Reich was that neither its Führer nor his three leading henchmen were the embodiment of the Aryan ideal as propagated by National Socialism. Hermann Göring, 1893-1946, the portly, arrogant head of the Luftwaffe, one of his many roles, was addicted to morphine as well as fine clothes. Sentenced to death at Nuremberg, he cheated the hangman by swallowing cyanide on the eve of his execution. Heinrich Himmler, 1900-45, weaselly head of the SS and one of the key figures of the Holocaust, also committed suicide after capture by British forces, having failed in his attempt to negotiate a peace treaty with the Allies behind Hitler's back. The physically frail Joseph Goebbels, 1897-45, Hitler's greatest fan and Nazi Germany's propaganda chief, killed his children before he and his wife took their own lives in Hitler's bunker. Martin Bormann, 1900-45, who gets frequent mention in the novel, became very close to Hitler in later years. As the Führer's trust in him grew, so did his power within the regime, while his relationship with Himmler, amongst others, became increasingly antagonistic. For many years after the war, uncertainty prevailed over Bormann's fate, and the West German government did not officially abandon the hunt for him until 1971. It was later accepted that he was killed while trying to escape from Berlin at the end of the war. Heinrich Müller, 1900-45, chief of the Gestapo, was another leading Nazi whose death has remained a matter of mystery. It is assumed that he died in May 1945, but no physical remains have ever been found. Of the other Nazi figures referred to here, perhaps the best known is Rudolf Hess, 1894-1987, Hitler's deputy from 1933-1941. at which point he took the madcap decision to pilot a plane to Britain in a solo attempt to negotiate with the government. Hess's Messerschmitt crashed in Scotland, and his peace efforts came to naught. He was sentenced to life imprisonment at Nuremberg, and he lived out the rest of his life at Spandau Prison in Berlin, where for more than 20 years he was the only inmate, guarded by soldiers and warders from the four victorious Allied powers. Albert Speer, 1905-81, is best known for his role as chief architect of the Third Reich, although he also became minister for armaments during the war. Speer was responsible for the new Reich Chancellery, which Hitler refers to in the novel, as well as the Nuremberg parade grounds. After the war, Speer was imprisoned for 20 years for his complicity in the crimes of the Third Reich. Ernst Röhm, 1887-1934, was on the radical wing of the Nazi Party that was pressing for social revolution. Head of the SA, Röhm was executed as part of the Night of the Long Knives in summer 1934. Reinhard Heydrich, 1904-42, referred to in the novel by first name only, was the brutal and ruthless deputy protector of occupied Bohemia and Moravia, as well as one of the main instigators of the Holocaust. Heydrich was assassinated in Prague by a group of Czech and Slovak officers, following orders from their government in exile. Julius Streicher, 1885-1946, the Jew-baiter of Nuremberg, founded the newspaper Der Stürmer, which Hitler recalls in the kiosk. A virulent anti-Semite, his behaviour was condemned as excessive by other leading Nazis, and his star waned after 1938, in spite of his close relationship with the Führer. Streicher was hanged for his incitement of the Holocaust, even though he had not been directly involved. Another leading Nazi executed at Nuremberg was Joachim von Ribbentrop, 1893-1946, wine salesman turned foreign minister, via a spell as ambassador to London. An incorrigibly vain man, Ribbentrop added the von to his name through his aunt's aristocratic connections. Robert Ley, 1890-1945, was head of the German Labour Front, which established the Strength Through Joy leisure organisation for the masses. He committed suicide while on trial at Nuremberg. Walter Funk, 1890-1960, served as a propaganda minister in the Third Reich, later becoming economics minister. He was imprisoned after the war, but released in 1957 due to poor health. Ernst Hampfstengel, 1887-1975, was an early supporter of Hitler who introduced him into Munich society and later worked as chief of the Foreign Press Bureau for the Nazis. He fell from favour in the mid-1930s and later fled Germany. Franz Schedel, 1906-45, was the commander of the Führer's SS bodyguard. He shot himself the day after Hitler committed suicide. Ulrich Graf, 1887-1950, and Max Ernst von Scheubner-Richter, 1894-1923, were both shot during Hitler's beer hall putsch of 1923. The former survived, despite having taken 11 bullets to the body. A number of leading military figures are cited throughout the book. Chief amongst these is Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz, 1891-1980, Commander-in-Chief of the German Navy from 1943. Hitler nominated Dönitz head of state after his death. There was little left for him to do but authorise Germany's unconditional surrender on the 7th of May 1945. Sentenced to 10 years imprisonment at Nuremberg, Dönitz lived almost another 25 years following his release in 1956. Wilhelm Keitel, 1882-1946, Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces, and his deputy, Alfred Jodl, 1890-1946, likewise played leading roles in the surrender. both were tried and hanged as war criminals at Nuremberg. Heinz Guderian, 1888 to 1954, and Walter Wenck, 1900 to 1982, were both army generals during the war, as was Felix Steiner, 1896 to 1966, whose failure to launch an offensive from Berlin in April 1945 was the trigger for Hitler's fit in the famous scene from Downfall, endlessly parodied on YouTube. Friedrich Paulus, 1890 to 1957, commanded the German forces in the Battle of Stalingrad, after which he spent 10 years in Soviet captivity. Walter von Brauchitsch, 1881 to 1948, was commander-in-chief of the German army at the beginning of the war, and one of the key players in the Blitzkrieg against France. When the army failed to take Moscow, however, Brauchitsch fell from favour. Of the other historical figures referred to in the novel, the best known may be Werner von Braun, 1912 to 77, the father of rocket science, who took the decision to surrender to the Americans rather than Russians in 1945, and whose work was partially responsible for the moon landings in 1969. Konrad Zuse, 1910 to 95, was another German engineer who is often credited with being the inventor of the computer. The wily Franz von Papen, 1879 to 1969, was surprised to find himself on trial with Göring et al. At Nuremberg, as he was a representative of Germany's old conservative elite rather than a Nazi, one of the faction which believed it could manipulate Hitler and use the mass appeal of National Socialism to further its own ends. A key player in smoothing the way for Anschluss in 1938, von Papen then spent most of the war as ambassador to Turkey. Acquitted at Nuremberg, von Papen did a short spell in prison after being convicted by a German court. Hjalmar Schacht, 1877 to 1970, was likewise acquitted at Nuremberg, having been ousted as Minister of Economics in 1937. A decade earlier, Schacht's efforts had helped put an end to the hyperinflation in Germany. Erich Kempka, 1910 to 75, was the Führer's chauffeur from 1934 to 1945, and one of those tasked with burning Hitler's and Eva Braun's bodies after they committed suicide. Adam Müller, 1884 to 1945, was a publisher and also ran a printing firm, which was responsible for both Mein Kampf and the official Nazi paper, the Völkischer Beobachter. He hanged himself in his cell after being arrested by the Americans. Josef Stolzing-Czerny, 1869 to 1942, was a journalist who wrote for the Völkischer Beobachter and who read a draft of Mein Kampf. Fritz Todt, 1891 to 1942, who died in a plane crash during the war, was an engineer involved in the building of the German Autobahnen, motorways, after 1933. Later, his Todt organization, whose staff included Friedrich Tams, 1904-80, built the defensive line in the west, as well as Hitler's military HQ on the eastern front, the Wolf's Lair. The Jewish Tietz family introduced the department store to Germany and established the Kaufhof chain, which is still going strong. Theodor Morell, 1886-1948, was Hitler's personal physician, known for his unconventional treatments. Morbidly obese, he died from a stroke. Leni Riefenstahl, 1902-2003, has been called the greatest female filmmaker of the 20th century. She became mesmerized with Hitler in the early 1930s and produced a number of impressive propaganda films for the Nazis, most famously Triumph of the Will. Also a photographer, dancer, and actress, she went on to have a long and successful career after the war, although to many her legacy is tainted by her association with the Nazi regime. Heinrich Hoffmann, 1885 to 1957, met Hitler in 1919 and soon became the Nazi Party's official photographer. Eva Braun worked in his studio, which is how she got to know Adolf. Geli Raubal, 1908-31, was Hitler's half-niece, with whom he lived from 1929 until her suicide 2 years later. Hitler adored Geli and was a domineering presence in her life, keeping a close watch on her every move. Traudl Junge, 1920-2002, was the Führer's secretary from December 1942 until his death. The film Downfall was based on her recollections of the last days of the Reich. The conversation between the teenage boys in the dry cleaners will probably leave the non-German reader as much at a loss as it does Hitler, and some clarification here may be helpful. Stromberg is a popular German comedy, which has so far run to 5 series. Inspired by the BBC hit The Office, it stars Christoph Maria Herbst, who, for his performance as Bernd Stromberg, won the same Adolf Grimme Prize that Hitler is awarded in the novel. Coincidentally, Herbst also narrated the German audiobook of Look Who's Back. The other Stromberg refers to a send-up that was a regular feature on Switch Reloaded, a parody show on German television. In it, the Stromberg character becomes a rather ineffectual Hitler figure, trying to solve the problems of the Third Reich from his office on the Obersalzberg in the Bavarian Alps. Stefan Raab, Harold Schmidt, and Hape Kerkeling are mentioned in the same breath early in the novel. All three are well-known figures of television comedy and recipients of the Adolf Grimme Prize. Amongst other things, Raab has hosted a German talent show. He also composed and performed the forgettable Wada Hada Duda Da at the 2000 Eurovision Song Contest, somehow finishing 5th. Schmidt hosted a late-night chat show on German television where he would occasionally do Hitler impersonations. Kerkeling has appeared in many comedy shows and once almost succeeded in gaining entrance to the official residence of the German president when he dressed up as Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands. Mario Barth and Ingo Appelt are both veterans of the German comedy scene, while Atze Schröder is a fictitious character whose performer refuses to reveal his true identity and has successfully defended his right to remain anonymous in court. Finally, a guide to the acronyms dotted liberally throughout the book. The full name of the Nazi Party was the Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, National Socialist German Workers' Party, or NSDAP. Readers may well be familiar with the Nazi organizations of the SA, Sturmabteilung, and particularly the SS, Schutzstaffel. The former, under Ernst Röhm, was the original paramilitary wing of the Nazi Party, its thuggish stormtroopers in their trademark brown shirts regularly beating up political opponents on the left. After the 1934 purge, however, the organization was eclipsed by Himmler's SS, which became one of the most powerful entities in Nazi Germany, and was in great measure responsible for the worst humanitarian crimes committed in the Third Reich. The DNVP, Deutsche Nationale Volkspartei, was another nationalist party in interwar Germany, with a more conservative and thus smaller following than the Nazis. Believing it could piggyback on the mass appeal of National Socialism, the DNVP was one of the factions responsible for helping Hitler to power in 1933. IG Farben was a vast pharmaceutical conglomerate which notoriously produced the Zyklon B used to gas millions in the Holocaust. Modern German political parties love acronyms too. The CDU, Christian Democratic Union, is the centre-right party of Angela Merkel. In Bavaria, the same movement is represented by its more conservative sister party, the CSU, Christian Social Union. On the left is the SPD, Social Democratic Party of Germany, while the FDP, Free Democratic Party, is the German Liberal Party,
which has frequently been a coalition partner in government. The NPD, National Democratic Party, is the home of the far right in Germany, while BIG, Alliance for Innovation and Justice, is a minority party representing Muslims and their integration in Germany. Jamie Bullock. Thanks for listening to Look Who's Back by Timor Vermesh, translated from the German by Jamie Bullock and read by Julian Rind-Tutt. For more great translated fiction, do visit us online at www.maklehosepress.com. Copyright 2012 by Bastei Lübbe AG. English translation copyright 2014 by Jamie Bullock. Copyright in recording, Quercus Publishing, PLC, 2014.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.